Hey everybody, I'm Sarah McNulty. I run Skype a Scientist, and today we're joined by sci-fi author Chuck Wendig. Is that how you pronounce your last name?
It is, you did it.
Woo! Okay,
so
good.
So many people get that wrong, that's okay.
I was like, I know in German sometimes IG ends in like something sounding different, so anyway. So welcome, we're really excited to have you here today.
Thank you.
Normally we talk to scientists, but today this whole week we're kind of doing something a little different, talking about kind of science adjacent folks who bring science into art and other places. And so we're happy that you're all here. One note is that sometimes things in Chuck's books get a little bit dark. So if you have really, really tiny guys, use caution maybe.
Yeah.
But we're gonna be as friendly as possible. So
Yeah.
So if you like what we're doing at Skype a Scientist, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/Skype a Scientist or on PayPal directly. We are a 501c3, so you can, all of this is all tax deductible if you donate at paypal.me/Skype a Scientist. So Chuck, would you like to introduce yourself and everything that you do?
Oh my, yes. Hi, I am Chuck Wendig. I am an author of too many books, and I should stop. Probably. So if this is my intervention, I really appreciate it if you could all just be gentle in this difficult time. No, I've written over 20 books across a variety of genres, fantasy, horror, and obviously science fiction. And so my latest is Wanderers. And so that's kind of the big, because I inadvertently predicted some of the things that were happening currently right now. I was not attempting to write about 2020, but rather about 2016. And yet here we are. So that's me. You can find me on Twitter at Chuck Wendig or my blog, terribleminds.com.
Awesome. So what, you mentioned about 2016. So did the 2016 election at all like inspire you to change anything that you were doing or?
Well, yeah, Wanderers grew out of that. I had the idea for Wanderers, which is to say just the core component of Wanderers, which was to say sleepwalkers, people sleepwalking one by one toward an unknown destination. I didn't know if they were good. I didn't know if they were bad. I literally didn't know anything about them. So all I had was this mechanical idea, and I had no story. I had no characters. I had nothing. And I would constantly revisit this notion and try to plug and play things into it. Nothing was coming together. And then about 10 years ago was the year 2016. And everything, actually, it was really like 2015 as stuff started to ramp up. All of my anxieties manifested, whether climate change or the post-antibiotic age or pandemic response, obviously, they formed like my anxiety Voltron. And turns out that also contextualized for me everything about this book. And it like fell into place in a really almost spooky sense. Normally I'm an outliner and I didn't outline this book. It was a very strange experience, but this definitely came out of that sort of strange cultural shift and political shift and scientific shifts and everything that was happening in the build up to and including the 2016 election.
Yeah, I formed Skype a Scientist right after the 2016 election.
And thank you.
The scientists were all just in an absolute panic kind of, and just screaming into the void on Twitter.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to find a way for us to do something useful with our anxiety instead of just biting our fingernails and yelling at each other. So
yeah, I'm not sure I have fingernails anymore.
Yeah, I put this tough monster stuff on top and then I
can't
do it anymore. Yeah. But anyway, so you are also involved in writing Star Wars books.
I am.
How did you get involved in that?
I tweeted about it. That's normally not how you would get a job of that magnitude. But I once I knew there was new Star Wars movies coming out, I just tweeted that, boy, I'd like to write some Star Wars novels someday. Like, that's really all it was. And unbeknownst to me, a number of people who were sort of peripherally or directly involved with the franchise kind of kicked that ball downfield a little bit and ended up in the right ears, I guess. And in New York Comic Con, I met with one of the Delray editors at the time, Shelley Shapiro. And she was like, well, I read your book. So I was like, oh, well, so I don't have the job then. Thanks. Good talking to you. She's like, no, I read the other books. And I say, oh, okay. I don't know what that meant. So it turns out she read my young adult series, which was the Heartland trilogy, which is, I kind of have had it described as me, or as John Steinbeck meets George Lucas. John Steinbeck's version of Star Wars. So she liked it, and they thought it was appropriate that I could handle the job, and I turned in an outline very quickly because, as it turns out, they needed content very, very quickly. And so I originally had, I think, 3 months to write the book, and I so I pitched it, and they approved it, and I started writing it literally the same day that my first writing shed was done. And I sat down, I was like, perfect, my battle station is complete, and I'm ready to focus all my laser energy on the planet in front of me. And I got an email that day, and she's like, hey, good news. I was like, oh, what's the good news? She's like, well, that book that was going to be coming out in November is now coming out in September. I was like, oh, that's great. And ironically, it would turn out to release literally 1 year to the day from my tweet asking to write for Star Wars. But she's like, so funny story about losing 2 months on publication schedule. That means we also are going to lose 2 months on your time to write it. So I had 3 months, was cut down to 1 month. And I wrote a first draft in a month, which is not entirely unusual for me. I can do that. I come out of a freelance writing background. I was used to doing a lot of word count very quickly and cleanly. And obviously that doesn't mean the book was done in a month. It was, I finished a first draft in a month. We had edits and so forth subsequently. But yeah, it was a really short rubber meets road time from writing it to publication. It was pretty intense.
That's wild. I don't know how, the idea of writing a book in that time period is like mind blowing.
Yeah, yeah.
Fiction seems so hard because everything we write in science is all like, I did this and then I did this and then yeah. I did this and then here's the statistics, and it's very, you don't have to like, all the imagining is done. The writing part, because all your imagination happened at the beginning when you were doing the experiment, but that's awesome. So what's your favorite part of the book writing process?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I'm not one of those people who doesn't like the writing. There are a number of writers who, and it's fair, I get it, who are like, they just want it done. They don't like the actual process, but I like the process because everything else is out of my control. When the book is coming out and the cover and you know, I mean, editing to some degree is in my control, what edits I allow and everything. But once it reaches an audience's hands, it ceases to sort of be mine at that point. So I really like the time when it's just me and the book. So I like those moments when you're writing, even in a first draft, and it's like lightning in a bottle. You don't really realize there are things you didn't know, you couldn't plan for. Even if I outline or don't outline, there are always, you know, on that highway journey across America, there are exits you didn't expect to see. You're like, that's his bat cave. I want to take that exit and find out what's there. Right. And then you take it, and it sometimes changes the story in a way you didn't even anticipate. And those are really wonderful moments.
That's really cool. So when you are kind of in the process of planning out a book, writing these science fiction, horror, fantasy books, are you like, do you ever come to a point where you're like, okay, I need some kind of something to happen here, and I know a little bit about the scientific topic of, let's say, pandemics or climate change. Do you then, are you inspired by the science first, or do you then go to the science to figure out how it works, or do you just say, I'm just gonna do my best here and hope it's real?
It's, for me, a loop. It begins with science, because like the stuff that goes into Wanderers is not stuff I didn't already know. I knew because I was reading it, because I'm fascinated by it, and I'm occasionally horrified by it. Not horrified by the science, but pandemics are terrifying.
Yeah, isn't it horrifying? Yeah.
Fungus is weird, and ants are, like when I wrote Invasive, ants are strange and maddening and exciting and also terrifying in their own weird little way. So, you know, it always begins with something, and it's why I like to read nonfiction more than fiction these days, because nonfiction gives me ideas, whereas fiction gives me someone else's ideas. And not to say that's not bad. I still love falling into a wonderful book, and I still read as much fiction as I can. But in terms of the utility of it, because I'm always writing something, I prefer to have something triggering my ideas rather than me sort of just taking what other people have done and using that. So obviously it starts with the foundation of learning things about topics and scientists and scientific ideas, and reading different books and just building on that. And then once you start kind of wandering into the dark woods of fiction, you inevitably hit those giant question marks. And that's when it's time to either reread something or talk to an expert on the matter, or try to make it up, but in a way that's, I always call it my like 3-in-1 rule. Like if you're gonna make something up, especially in a scientific dimension, you wanna say 3 true things before you get to the lie. Uh-huh. Because that way it feels like you're building off of something that's real, and it's building off of an organic path of fact and truth, so to speak. as opposed to just saying a thing and making it like, well, that, you know, people are full of bees. And you're like, that's not true. You didn't establish any. It's fine if it's in a pulp context and you're trying to just, like, Star Wars can just make stuff up. Star Wars can just be like, yeah, this hunk of junk flies. And then they like, TIE fighters yell. I don't know why they yell. They just yell in space because it's awesome. That's why. But in something that's a little more of a science fiction, either near future or hard science fiction, you kind of want to get it right, or at least in a way that feels right. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So when did you know you wanted to be a writer, and how did you get to where you are today?
Boy, I just woke up in a dish one day and I just thought I should do this. No, like eighth grade was when I realized I had a revelation in eighth grade that people got paid to do this. Like I don't think I knew that. And maybe that's just because in eighth grade, you don't really, though they do kind of try to drill the idea of what do you want to do for a job into you. One of the, like the arts almost never comes up. It's always like, you want to be a scientist, a lawyer, a doctor? What do you want to be? It's never like painting. You know, they don't even tell you that you can make that as a career. That feels almost like a hobby. That's almost how they sell it. So I was in kind of an argument with my like eighth grade teacher and over a word, a definition of a word. And it, somewhere along the way, I showed that like an author used the word that she said didn't exist. So like, that's where I got it. And somewhere in there, there was this connection that like, well, this is a book that someone bought and someone paid for. And that's a career. I was like, oh, I want to do that. And I, prior to that, I wanted to be a cartoonist. And it turns out that actually requires more work. And I was like, I don't know that I can invest. I didn't want to invest in learning how to do art, but I did want to invest in learning how to make words. So.
Cool. So you said you read a lot of nonfiction. So what is a nonfiction book you've read in the last year that you've found inspiration in some way?
Oh, nonfiction that I've read. Well, I'm reading a book right now on Johnny Appleseed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, about halfway through it. So it's not done, but it's an astonishing look at the weirdness that is the real, you know, John Chapman, Johnny Appleseed. It's like the man, the myth, the legend. I confess the author's name escapes me, but it's really good. It's a very captivating read on this. And it's sort of fascinating to sort of see the journey of how he viewed grafting versus planting seeds, and the fact that he was, I didn't even realize he was a Swedenborgian, which is a religion that is local to us because you're Philadelphia, right?
Yeah.
It's Brynaffen. There's a little religion in Brynaffen called Swedenborgianism based on the works of Emanuel Swedenborg. And that's why they have that cathedral there in Brynaffen. Right. And this idea that this guy, Emanuel Swedenborg, he believed he went to heaven and met all these angels, and he continued to write about his psychic experiences with heaven and God and angels. And it was an actual religion was formed off of it, far smaller than something like, you know, Quakerism. And John Chapman was a Swedenborgian. So it's just sort of interesting to see how his seed planting came out of his Swedenborgian experience, but also how, you know, all the stuff he grew led to the cider being, you know, a primary beverage in colonial America, and how also then in Prohibition, they chopped down all of his orchards because they were making cider out of these funky apples. And so and then you get that apple a day, keeps the doctor away. So apples became less a thing during Prohibition of making cider and sin, and more a thing of health and you know, prudence and providence.
Gotcha. Cool. So do you feel that you need to use your imagination a lot at work?
Like when I'm writing?
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. It's predominantly that. I mean, I don't know. It's just, yeah. But the imagination only gets you so far. The imagination is like, you know, it's like a big bin full of junk. And you have to take those things and glue them together into the gluing together part that's the work. The imagination part is easy, I think, for most writers. Everyone always asks us where we get our ideas from. And I always say the better question to ask a writer is, how do you make them stop? And usually it turns out how we make them stop is by trying to write one of them diligently. But that's not even true, because then we get 1,000 ideas tantalizing us as we're writing the one thing.
So could you go over your outlining process?
No, I couldn't, because it's a trade secret. No, I don't have one. It's easy to say, you know, do this, do that. But I think every book I do a different kind of outline. Like even when I first wrote Blackbirds, my first actual published novel, the outline that I used was a screenplay that I had written of the idea because I was unable to write the book and I couldn't finish it and I didn't know what to do with it. I felt like you ever walk into a room and you don't know why you went in there. And that was my experience writing that book. I would just like wander halfway through it and be like, I forget why I'm here. And then I would have to rewrite it and same thing would happen again and again and again. And so I won a screenwriting competition because I didn't know what I was trying to do with my life. And the prize of that competition was you sat down with a mentorship for a year with a screenwriter. And the screenwriter was a guy named Steven Susko. And he told me, he's like, we need to outline. I was like, no, we don't do that in novels. We don't outline. That's for you Hollywood people. But as it turns out, that is what I needed for that book. And ultimately, the screenplay that came out of that became the outline for the novel Blackbirds. But every outline is, for me, different. It depends first, does the client need it? Like on Star Wars, they actually need you to write them a somewhat proper outline. Sometimes it's like an outline that's only digestible by me. Like you would look at it and think you found, you know, some heretic document, some Lovecraftian thing. It wouldn't make any sense to human eyes. Sometimes, like Wanderers, I didn't do an outline, which is, again, strange for an 800-page book that didn't even change much from first draft to second. But I just did chapters. I would write periodic chapters throughout the book, and they form sort of the spine of it. So it's always different every time. Mostly it's just me talking my way through the book.
Cool. So two related questions. One is, what's the most significant book that or piece of writing that you feel that you've made? And what's your favorite piece of writing that you've done?
Ooh, that's hard. Significant. I always hate, that's a hard one to answer because I don't want to feel like any of my works are particularly significant. I was like, I don't know. Their impact is whatever their impact is. I can't,
right.
I don't feel comfortable defining that. It does feel like Wanderers hit at a certain moment. And it continues to just sort of get a lot of traction and press given everything going on around us. And even before this happened, it was kind of capturing certain things of our current moment. Favorite might have been the third Miriam Black book, The Cormorant, like is another book that kind of just fell out of my brain. And it happened very easy and very quickly. And I really enjoyed writing it, and I kind of liked reading it after, which is not always true. A lot of times we read our books, and we're like, oh, this is a mistake. You're just like, hey, can I just burn it? Am I allowed to burn it? The publisher's like, no, it's too late. You can't burn this.
We've already published them.
It's happening, yeah. This is happening. We paid you. It's too late. But Cormorant, I just kind of dug. I felt like it did everything I wanted it to do, and I was very happy with it.
Awesome. So how do you deal with naysayers on social media?
That's hard because in theory it's easy in that you just, you know, you kind of shore up your social media filters and you block whenever appropriate and you try to only amplify the ones where you feel like you need to respond to something or you kind of want to call attention to an idea that you need to rebut or someone, God forbid, that you hope people will help you report who's threatened you or whatever it is. And then try to ignore the rest. But that's so much easier said than done when it turns into a real, like, tsunami. And sometimes it can.
Yeah.
Without knowing, always, sometimes you don't even know why that it happens. So the best advice I can give, and it's not always advice I'm following, so be advised, is to just get out for a little while. You can put it down and look away, and you can lock your account and just, like, walk away for a while.
Yeah. Anytime I've had trolls show up for me, it's like nothing good comes of one.
No.
It's just not worth your time because they're not there to have a conversation.
They're not there to
be
productive.
They're there for just a nightmare. But this week, I actually learned something this week. So I there was this group that was putting out books for free that the authors weren't getting paid for, that NPR mentioned. And then someone had asked a question that I thought was interesting is, what is the difference between piracy and libraries, and what do authors get out of the library system?
Yeah, so a lot of people don't understand that, as it turns out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So would you mind answering that for us?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I actually used to work for the library system here in Pennsylvania, or one of the library systems, Buck County. And you know, a library system buys books, both in print, and they buy access to digital books. And then usually, depending on how it is negotiated, after a certain number of lending, whether it's an ebook or in physical, they repurchase either the license or they repurchase a copy of the book. Because as the book starts to fall apart and sustains damage, they'll purchase a new book, and then they'll either sell that on a donation sale or give it away or whatever it is they're going to do. So that's where our royalties come from in that system of a library, that they're purchasing the books and repurchasing the books when needed. And they can only put, especially on a digital license, that book can only be out with a certain number of people at a certain period of time. And so it's a restriction, just like it would be on a print copy. Now, there is certainly a conversation as to how publishers are not always great to libraries as to how that works. And it's not always in a library's favor. And sometimes libraries are being charged overly much, or they can't get new books, or they're charged a lot for new books, whatever that is. So there it certainly is a conversation as to how those need to loosen up. But piracy is just someone yeah. has the text of the book and they put it somewhere and right. then anybody can have it. Right. Whether for, you know, in this case of this Internet Archive, they can have it for 2 weeks, which is what they're saying, or only a certain number of people can have it at a time. But that's part of their trick now, is the so-called emergency library they have eradicated under what they believe is fair use copyright, which I feel is a reach, and publishers certainly feel is a reach. And even a lot of libraries feel is a reach, because it's diminishing their ability to do this too. When they say, well, anybody can have it for, you know, 2 weeks still, but like anybody can have it, a million people can have it, then you can just re-get it after 2 weeks, you just click the thing and it. So it's the 2 weeks limit is not even a meaningful limit at that point, but right. we'll see.
Has there been any conversation? So of course, at least in Philadelphia, all the libraries are closed, mm-hmm. But we can still get content on our phones for yes. ebooks and mm-hmm. that kind of
thing. Or e-readers, sure, absolutely.
Yeah, totally. So has there been any conversation between publishers and libraries at all about maybe making the titles that the publishers can confirm the library physically has and giving them like a temporary ebook license just to keep people doing something?
I know like Penguin Random House and some other publishers have they've allowed, you know, if you want to reproduce the book in terms of like, I think reading it online and giving some, you know, reading it for kids, especially kids books, doing a lot yeah. of readings on YouTubes. YouTube, I just pluralized YouTubes like an old man. YouTube. The YouTubes, on the YouTubes today, the kids yeah. are reading the books. So, but I can't speak to what they've done. I know they've, Macmillan loosened their pricing structure and their release structure with, because theirs was actually a little, in my opinion, not a little, but somewhat considerably draconian compared to some other publishers as to how libraries were able to release that content and when and how much it cost them to repurchase. Right. So they've gone back to their old model, which was better for libraries. I can't promise it was still great. But so I know some of them have rolled back some of their restrictions, but I don't know what else is in the works there. My publisher tends to be pretty communicative to me about that. But I mean, I'm communicative, for instance, with my editor, but my editor is not the person who makes these decisions in any way. Right. So she doesn't always know what's going on. It's not like it's not a team of like five people and we get together and figure out the future of publishing, right. together. So I am not super hyped into what's coming, but my understanding is that is a conversation. Yes.
Cool. So I don't know what this question means. It comes from one of the folks that are here from Tasha. How did a tweet thread turn into "you might be the killer"?
Oh, well, during the healthcare vote, when John McCain famously developed the backbone that he had claimed he had and remembered that he had it, and did that Obamacare saving, you know, vote. At the time, a friend, a fellow author, excellent author, Sam Sykes, and I were doing, he tweeted at me something about like, hey, I'm a camp counselor now. Like, could you just tweet nonsense back and forth? And we just sort of tweeted this story back and forth to each other, and it ended up being like, well, there's this killer on the camp where he's counseling, but then are you sure you're not actually the serial killer? And then let's go through the test and find out if you're the slasher who's killing everybody, and it turns out he is. And that went kind of viral. And next thing we knew, we had interest in it. Anytime anything goes viral, people always say, we want to make it into a movie or a TV show. And you're like, sure you do.
Okay, yeah.
So we had, YouTube channels trying to make it, and someone wanted to turn it into a like a cartoon, but it was like a therapist talking to his client. And then we had the people who made like Sharknado and stuff contact us from Sci-Fi, and they were like, we would like to do this and turn this into a movie. We were like, hell yeah, you
do. Okay, yeah.
So yeah, and they did, and it aired on Sci-Fi. So I mean,
that's awesome.
You can watch it. Some places you can watch it for free, but or you can buy it on iTunes. That's awesome. And the characters are Sam and Chuck. And Chuck is played by Allison Hannigan, you know, Willow from Buffy. So that was a weird experience, but wonderful.
That's weird and awesome. Yeah. I love that. The things that come out of Twitter, you never...
That's the thing. Like, it's a hell realm in a lot of ways, but yeah. I could not leave it if I wanted to. It's got so much gold to it.
Agreed. Do you ever base a book on something / someone you see / love from Shiloh and Josias?
I mean, ideas more than people. First of all, because we technically don't ever do that. So it's not so much about like people I love, but like ideas I love or things I love or things I'm interested in. It kind of goes back to that. Like if I read something and it's fascinating, my brain desperately wants to shove that into a book somehow. And it often will, in many ways. And usually that's like I let that happen because it's usually a puzzle piece I was missing for the book. Or for something that I hadn't figured out about a thing, or even a whole new idea can grow out of just because I love stuff. And if I really like a thing, you tend to want to be excited about it and engage with it in interesting ways.
Awesome. So have you ever drawn inspiration from another author's book or piece, like a fiction?
Well, I mean, only in the sense that I'm excited to read other people's works, and it makes me want to do that as well. So sometimes you read a book. I'm reading a book right now, and it's an ARC, so it's not out yet, but it's very good, and it's pandemic-y, so just everyone be advised on that one. It's Lauren Bucus's, it's After Land. I have it right here. Oh, she'll show the cover. It's a great cover. Great cover. Lauren Bucus, After Land. So the first page made me want to quit being a writer. I was like, it's too good. It's just too good. I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. Like it's too good. And you get over that and you're like, you eventually learn to like love that because it's challenging and interesting. And it's, you know, it lets you sort of fall into a book. Sometimes I read a book and it's not the fault of the author, but just because I'm familiar with genre and storytelling and stuff, you start to kind of like, well, I either know where this is going or I'm not engaged by it. Even if 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 readers will be. It's not a knock against the author of the book. It's just something didn't connect with me on it. But this is just one of those books where it's both inspiring and damning in equal measure. So I'm like, oh, it's too good. It's too good. She's so good. It's not fair.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So would you say that you have a favorite book?
No, but I do have books that I return to. So that's definitely a thing. Robin Hobb's Assassin's Apprentice is a book I have returned to many times. Actually, the trilogy in general, the first trilogy. Second trilogy is also great, but I don't think I've ever reread that. Robert McCammon's Swan Song is an apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic nuclear winter nightmare that is so good. It's like 980 pages of wonderful horror. Trying to think of what else I may have reread recently. Lloyd Alexander's Pride and Chronicles. That's something that we read at night with my son. Though he is now, that has been put on hold because of Rick Riordan's Percy Jackson series. He's like 8 years old, about to turn 9, and he has fallen. He's into Greek myth stuff now, and so that hit it like lightning.
Hey,
zing.
How do you overcome writer's block?
That is one of those really difficult questions. So I always feel like the first thing you need to do is figure out if it's really writer's block. By which I mean writers are somewhat mercurial creatures and we are subject to anxiety and depression. Not uncommon. And I say that as a good thing. It's not uncommon with anybody. But with writers, you know, you should make sure that you know that it's not an uncommon thing. It doesn't make you problematic or strange or anything like that. Super normal. But if you try to solve anxiety or depression as if it's writer's block, you will only heighten your anxiety and depression. And so it's real vital to sort of get a like a real talk sort of hold on what's stopping you from writing. If it's just a, if it's like literal writer's block, first of all, that's also a thing that's not special. And by which I mean, it's not unique even to writers. I mean, there are plumbers who don't know how to solve a problem that day and they need time to think about it. And that's just all that it takes. Mathematicians don't always know how to solve their problems. People in general, we don't always know how to solve our problems. So that being said, then, you know, the solutions for writer's block are usually simple. Sometimes it's go back into the book a little bit and find out maybe you took a left turn when you should have taken a right. Maybe it means it's just not a good day for writing and you need to back away. Maybe you haven't thought it through enough or outlined it enough. I don't think every writer needs to outline, as I noted, it's different for me every time. But you know, back when I got that screenwriter competition thing and he told me I had to outline, like the lesson for me was that I had to outline, but the lesson for everybody is not, you have to outline. The lesson is when your process isn't working, you need to change your process. And so for me, you know, sometimes it means the writer's block is just, you have the wrong process. You think you write a certain way and you don't. Or for me, every book demands a different process. Wanderers, I couldn't write like I wrote the books that came before it. And I had to learn that. I learn how to write every time I write a new book. And so, you know, at the end of the day, you do have to be, it's tricky, right? Because we try to walk that line, that perfect balance between gentle on ourselves and capable of self-care, while also not brooking too many excuses. Because if you're like, it's self-care, I just need to be gentle on myself, and then 6 months have gone by and you've done nothing, you're like, well, but self-care. You're like, well, okay, but now self-care has turned into the opposite. You're actually undermining yourself in the name of something else. But at the same time, you also can't be so hard on yourself that you're like, if I don't do this, you know, cancer won't be cured today. Like, well, that's not, you know, if you think too hard about any given thing, even an autonomous breathing, sleeping, if you think too hard about it, you're going to have difficulty with it. Think, you know, tonight, go to sleep and think real hard about sleeping and see how easily you fall asleep. It will not work out. It will not work out well. So writing is like that too. Sometimes you just worry too much about it and you have to care a little bit less about the day's work.
Yeah. That's solid advice for no matter what you do, for sure.
I hope so. Yeah.
It's hard. Okay. Sorry, I had a question and then I got all distracted by your answer. What are your views on books on tape?
I don't think we even call them that anymore. Do we call them books on tape anymore?
Like audiobooks.
Audiobooks. I love audiobooks.
I think I still call them books on tape.
Books on tape. I just have an old man yell it at me. That's how I do it. He follows me around and just yells my books at me. Oh God, I'm the old man now, aren't I? That's not good. I'm pro them. They're great. They're a different expression of what we do. And in terms of, if anybody cares, that we, you know, because some people think, people have very interesting ideas about how publishing industry works. They're like, do you get paid if it's an audio book? It's like, no, I get nothing. I get, of course I do. Yeah, of course I do. Ebooks, physical books, yeah, it's all good.
We got Peter says, I'm listening live from an ocean away in Europe. Do you ever think about your readers and the weird ways your writing reaches people that you'll never meet?
Yes, but I try not to think too hard about it, or it would make me go mad. If I think too much about, it's very hard to think about audience when I'm writing, because I don't know, I can't control that part. I can't control how books are being received. And so the best I can do is try to write the book that I think I want to write and the best story I can tell. I'm my first audience, you know, me and any of the people around me, my agent or wife or whomever. So after that, it'll break my brain if I think too much about who it's reaching in the various, both in terms of physical distance and temporal distance. I don't know how my books will be received in 10 years. They may be forgotten, and that's okay. But I can't change or control that.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts about continuing the story in Wanderers in some form?
I have a lot of thoughts on that. I always said that there will be a sequel if it is warranted both by, you know, audience reaction and sales. And in terms of if I have a story to tell, I know I do have a story to tell there, a second story. I think the publisher's happy. So we can talk more about that later.
Cool.
Yeah.
Have you ever co-written a book with another author?
I've never co-written a book, but I've co-written comics and film and TV stuff. I have a film and TV co-writer that I sometimes work with, Lance Weiler, who does cool indie films and horror stuff. And then on the comic side, I've worked with another novelist, actually, Adam Christopher. We did The Shield together for Archie Dark Circle Comics.
Cool. What is your favorite, like, movie monster?
Favorite movie monster? Ooh. Ooh. Mm. The Xenomorphs of Alien. The Alien universe, probably.
That's a good one.
One of the first things I ever did was, and I don't know why, I had was able to see the movie as a child, but like I was like 10 years old or something, and I drew a comic about Pac-Man versus the aliens. I don't know why I knew anything about aliens at 10 years old. I think it's because I would just go to the video store and my parents had no idea what movies were okay. So I'd just be like, well, that sounds good. I like E.T. How about Alien? That's also an alien movie. And then they'd be like, shut up. Here's their video. And then I would leave with it and watch that and be terrified.
Yeah, no Reese's Pieces in that one.
That's I mean, except what comes out of your guts.
Sure. Fair.
Yeah.
I think mine's probably the Gill Man from...
yeah, it's a follow-up. Yeah. Black Lagoon. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Mallory O'Meara's story on the that is really great.
Yeah, oh, cool.
Really, yeah.
All right, I will add that to my list of things to read. Have you ever started writing a book and then not finished it?
Many times. My entire life is, I'm like a serial killer of books. I've got chopped up book bodies in a bloody wake behind me. Yeah, I mean, I finished, I think, four or five books before I ever had one that was publishable. And those four or five books had probably 10 or 20 a piece that I didn't finish. So, I mean, you're talking about 100 books I've probably never finished. And sometimes there are, even now, like, there are some things that I started and didn't quite come together, or stuff that I had to pick up later. Like, the book I have coming out next, The Book of Accidents, is based on a book I did finish, but never a second draft. It was just a first draft and it was not good or great. So yeah.
Do you ever take like storylines or parts of the kind of chop block of all your old stuff and say like, oh, that didn't work in that story, but I think if I pull it into the one that I'm writing right now.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Like Book of Accidents has a little bit of some stuff I had done earlier that I didn't have a full story coalesced around them, but they were pieces that I liked. So yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Cool. What is your favorite part of your job and least favorite part of your job?
Oh, the favorite part of my job is... you know, it's weird, but it's kind of almost this kind of thing, both this and in person, like Q&A stuff. I think it's fun to interact with readers and to not just be, and to be sort of a bridge between them and the book in a way. So that's definitely one of my favorite things. But one of my unfavorite things, gosh, I don't know, waiting. Publishing is so slow. It's glacial. It's like watching a slug crawl down an icicle. It's just like, and you're just like refreshing your email, like, I'll get it. I have so many things right now that I could announce and I can't because everything is slow. And then with the pandemic, everything gets slower. It's not getting faster, slower. Yeah. Stupid pandemic.
Academic writing is also a nightmare.
I'm so sorry. Yeah.
It's the worst. And that's definitely, in my opinion, the worst part of being a scientist is trying to get papers published because I think the difference between a paper when you submit it and a paper when it's accepted, a lot of work went into those changes, but did the answer change?
Right.
Usually no. So why are we doing this to ourselves? But that's another question for another day.
That's a whole other thing.
I'm a science communicator now and not a scientist. But anyway, so we've got Nuno says, hey Chuck, big fan of your Star Wars books trilogy. Would you consider writing another one with a new set of characters?
Not at this point. I think not at this point. I feel like I said it on Twitter. It's just a little too, it's a rough crowd. And it's not Star Wars fans that are the rough crowd. Star Wars fans have been lovely. I go to events and meet the nicest, most enthusiastic people. But it's one of those things where online there is a, and it's not just like limited to one political side, though definitely isn't somewhat nastier on that side. But it can just be like people have really heightened ideas and ownership over a franchise like that. And so when you write in that world, you get really thrust into the crosshairs in a way that is difficult. I handled it as best as I could, but sometimes it was actually like hard. It was really like anxiety making. I mean, when the Aftermath came out, we launched it at Dragon Con at a Barnes & Noble for their Midnight Force Friday thing. And the crowd that came out was fun and snappy and lively. And I read from the book and we all had a good time. And that was midnight. And then like, I think we got in the car to go back to the hotel by like 1:30 was me and my one editor. And 1:32 a.m. And I was like, oh, let's just check Amazon. And there were already like 10 one-star reviews. And I was like, I don't understand how to,
read it.
Yeah, but I didn't even get to the point of like, well, how could they have read it? It was just like, oh no, I did something very bad. Right. I have screwed up super bad. And then I would have this like whiplash where I would be at Dragon Con meeting fans and they would read my book and come up and tell me about where they're at. And it was like super like, but then you get online and be like, I'd have like 50 one-star reviews. I'd be like, what is happening? Mm-hmm. It turns out it was a gay character that made people mad, or they didn't like, it was present tense. There were all kinds of things that certain people didn't like. The ownership of, and one person really coalesced it for me on one of the forums. They were like, well, I don't read anything other than Star Wars books. So like, who does he think he is writing something different than how you write Star Wars books? Despite the fact that that's what the publisher kind of wanted. We were trying to do something different and not just kind of write your standard stock tie-in novel.
Right.
So it was like this whiplash emotionally of just doing that. But it was fine, but it's tough. So I would much rather, and I don't own that. I get, paid okay for it, but I don't own that. So like, I'm kind of out on the wind for Disney, defending Star Wars, like it needs defenders. So you sort of taking a big hit emotionally to write those books, and I'd rather just write my own books and own them at the end of the day.
Right. Yeah, totally. That makes sense. All right. So we try to keep this at 45 minutes so that we're not rambling all day and all night. So I always ask two people same two questions of everyone. One is, what do you wish everybody in the world knew related to what you're an expert in, is what I normally ask. So somehow related to your field. The other question is, what do you wish everybody in the world knew at literally anything?
Oh gosh. I would say I wish everybody in the world knew how hard booksellers and librarians work. Not for like great reward. Like, it's not like they work hard, but they go home to their library mansions and it's great. You know what I mean? It's like they bust their tails doing that. And I think that's an important contextual component. And actually, that's also true for people inside publishing. I think it is sometimes viewed that big publishers are these sort of faceless empires. And they're just producing content and they're terrible. But and there's, again, something to be said for how large companies operate and do that in this world. But at the same time, there are individuals working inside these companies, editors and marketing people and designers, who are not the faceless automatons running massive empires. And they, again, bust their tails, and often not for as much reward as you would like them to have. So that's definitely the first thing I would like them to know. The second thing is just like either a media literacy or critical thinking. I think, with education being sort of kneecapped in parts of this country, you lose civics and media literacy and just the simple critical thinking skills, like how to challenge things that come across your eyes. And the internet is very good at bypassing all that because it makes it go really fast. Yeah. It's like flashing a bright light in your eyes. You're like, I'm dizzied by it, and I've taken it into my brain already, and now it lives there, and it's harder to get out once it's in. So to have those bouncers at the door who stop all pieces of information, be like, oh, whoa, hold up. And I fall prey to that too. Anybody can fall prey to that. But I think at least if you have a couple bouncers willing to sort of like, arm bar a couple randy ideas before they get into your bar and start throwing up, it helps.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me.
So could you remind us of, let's say, two of your book titles that you want people to check out and maybe where we can find those?
Yeah, absolutely. Wanderers is my latest. And again, it's about a pandemic, which is not relevant at all in any way. But it's also about artificial intelligence and climate change and culture and white supremacy. It's got a whole, which again, not relevant at all. None of it's relevant. We live in a fantasy world. It's fine. Everything is fine. So, and then if you want something that's a little less that, Blackbirds is the first book in my 6-book Miriam Black series, about a girl who can see how you're going to die when she touches you. It's a thriller. They're sort of tightly paced, as a, sort of the opposite of Wanderers in size and scope. They're like more like a scalpel between your ribs, as opposed to a big boulder crushing your skull. So you can buy those at any good indie bookstore, is the ideal location for them. My local Doylestown Books does ship. I currently can't go sign them if they ship them, because we're all staying. I can't sign at a distance. I could try to throw a pen at it. Maybe that would work. But they do ship. And most indies do ship right now. So that's a great, great service. So, and then you can find me online at Twitter, at Chuck Wendig, and my blog, terribleminds.com.
Cool. Also, I went to high school in Doylestown. I didn't know you were in Doylestown.
Where did you go to West?
I went to West, yeah.
I went to East.
Wow.
I didn't know that.
What are the chances? Okay, yeah. Well.
There it is.
That's awesome. Okay, so you can support Skype a Scientist. Tomorrow, we're talking at 1 p.m. Eastern, all about poop and really microbiology and how the microbes in your gut affect your health, with Jessica McCann, who is great, and she's going to be exciting. So you should tune in for that. You can support us at patreon.com/Skype a Scientist or paypal.me/Skype a Scientist. I hope you've had fun today. Thank you again, Chuck, for joining
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thanks, everybody.
Bye. And thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Aaron.